This is the takeaway for Tuesday, February 7th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And it is open conflict right now between the federal government and the courts. The Trump travel ban from seven predominantly Muslim countries has been temporarily halted by a judge, James Robart, from the Western Judicial District of Washington State in Seattle. The briefs were flying at all hours over the weekend and overnight. On Sunday, the Justice Department went over the head of Justice Robart to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, with jurisdiction in many Western states, to argue for the ban to be restored. The Ninth Circuit denied the administration and sided with the district court in Seattle. Will this case get to the eight justices of the Supreme Court, which is already deadlocked on a similar case of the limits of federal authority? Lawyers have questions. Families have questions. You have questions. Leon Fresco is a former deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. He has some answers. What we're seeing, he says, is a typical battle over policy, but conducted at light speed.
The end of any policy-making initiative, regardless of who is enacting that policy, is litigation. And so that's my slogan that I used to give to my lawyers at the Department of Justice was, you know, a policy is not enacted until all of the litigation is finished. And I think you're going to be seeing that in large quantities here during this administration, that every time a policy initiative is announced, litigation is filed challenging that policy initiative.
Is there an element of these challenges, though, that goes directly to the legitimacy of the presidency of the United States, whether you agree with Donald Trump or not, that ultimately is what the courts are going to be asked to decide in various cases?
I think the courts won't be deciding, is Donald Trump a legitimate president, but they will be deciding, were the actions taken by the Trump administration legitimate? Did they have some rational basis for it being enacted, or were they arbitrary and capricious? And to the extent that the court feels that a lot of what is being enacted doesn't have a basis in any actual rational study and thought, then there's going to be problems in the courts for the president. But I wouldn't call it a referendum on the president in the courts. I would just call it a referendum on the manner in which some of these policies are being executed.
All right. Let's answer this question from one of our listeners, Anna.
Hi, this is Anna Carvland from Blue Island, Illinois. My question is regarding the ban. How long would it take to get to the Supreme Court, and what status would it be in during that time?
At 6 p.m. Eastern Time on February 7th, the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit is going to be hearing oral argument on what's called the temporary restraining order that the judge in Seattle issued, which had put a stop to the travel ban. At any moment after that, which would, you know, the arguments probably will end at about 7:15 Eastern time, the Ninth Circuit could decide to either keep that stay in place, meaning that the travel ban would not be executed, or it could restore the ban. In either case, the losing party will try to take it to the Supreme Court. And the question would be, would the Supreme Court keep the ban in place or keep the stay in place, whichever one is the prevailing wisdom? And so that could happen in a matter of a day or two. But interestingly enough, where the case is right now is that such a preliminary posture, this temporary restraining orders posture, that's not really typically where the real action is in Supreme Court litigation. The Seattle court is going to go back and do what's called the motion for preliminary injunction. They're setting up the briefing for that. And it would be that appeal, which would ultimately work its way up to the Supreme Court, that would probably be the place where you'd see the real decision making, because this is just about what to do while that briefing is taking place. And my guess, which, you know, could be proven wrong in a matter of hours, will be that the Ninth Circuit will keep the stay in place, and then the Supreme Court will keep the stay in place because it will be deadlocked at 4-4. One of the very, very interesting questions that arises out of this particular lawsuit is whether the state of Washington has standing to bring the lawsuit.
Exactly.
Because
they're already in the country.
Well, and a more important fundamental point than that, when President Obama issued what was called the DAPA program, And the state of Texas sued. The Department of Justice argued very vigorously that Texas did not have standing. And that case deadlocked at 4-4, and it appeared like the liberal justices are arguing that Texas did not have standing, and the conservative justices were arguing that Texas did have standing. And so the question is that actually going to flip around?
Exactly, right.
I mean, and under what legal principle would that make any sense? Where you'd actually have four justices, all eight absolutely do a 180 on what they think about standing, which is not a political issue.
Standing, of course, is whether you have a grievance to file a lawsuit, and it is an issue in so many of these cases. I'm going to combine three questions here. Walterboro, South Carolina asks, how could a federal judge have authority over a presidential declaration? Who has authority over who? Stanford, Connecticut says, who will ultimately have the last say in this case? And Eugene, Oregon says, what would the consequences be should local immigration officers and personnel choose to follow the executive order instead of the court ruling? Can the courts assign some personnel to watch airports that might need this kind of oversight?
Well, so this is the crux of the democracy, which is that all of us are just hanging on by a thread, hoping that the institutions and the systems work as they will. The answer is the court has the final say. And if the court wants to throw someone in jail for contempt of court, the court can. But of course, if the people who would be doing the throwing in jail decide to turn against the courts and say, I refuse to execute this order, then the judges themselves are, they're not going to go out with guns and start shooting at people and throwing them in jail. And so this has always been the constitutional concern you have is, if you actually had a president who wanted to disregard the courts and say, good luck, try to throw me in jail, I dare you. What would happen in that situation?
Jackson already did it, and it's Article 3 versus Article 2 right now. Here's a great question from Kate.
Hi, this is Kate Lunsford from Bothell, Washington, and I'm just concerned that Trump's tweets criticizing an individual judge will change the relationship between the judicial branch and the executive branch.
Well, there was a tweet on, I think, Saturday where the president called the judge in Seattle a so-called judge. And so that one, in addition to the ones from the campaign, were causing some concern. Here's what I would say. As if I was a Department of Justice attorney right now going into court, I would be very nervous that the judges I'm in front of will have already a view about who I'm arguing on behalf of that's not helpful to my case. And so usually the best policy is to not comment on pending litigation in general, much less the actual judges making those decisions.
We are getting literally hundreds of responses on this question, and so many of them relate to who has authority here, who oversees the president. This is Article 3 versus Article 2 from Cleveland, Ohio. Who oversees the president? How much power do the judicial and executive branches each have? Are we moving towards a constitutional crisis?
I mean, don't forget Article 1 here, which is to say, if there really is a crisis between Article 2 and Article 3, and you actually had a president, the Article 2 president, actually disregarding Article 3 contempt orders, you could see impeachment proceedings in Article 1. I mean, that's what's supposed to happen in that situation. But again, we're in a completely new world and a new time. And I just don't know. But the way it's supposed to work, of course, is if a court issues an injunction and somebody violates that injunction, the court is supposed to throw that person into contempt proceedings. And the officers of the court are supposed to make sure that people who are in contempt are forced to do what the court is telling them to do.
Leon Fresco is former Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Leon, thanks so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
President Trump's executive orders on restricting immigration include financial penalties against cities that the president and the Department of Homeland Security deem sanctuary cities, cities that take no action to detain or deport individuals not accused of a crime who may have an immigration status that makes them deportable by the federal government. The city of Milwaukee says it is working with federal authorities to enforce federal orders. Philadelphia has put a freeze on enforcing it. California vows to defy the federal government to maintain its sanctuary cities policy, and Seattle will defy it as well. But Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez was one of the first officials to back away from Miami's sanctuary declaration, fearful of losing millions of funds. Miami-Dade County received a sanctuary label in a 2016 Justice Department report. Legal experts insist the mayor was not obligated to do what he did, and the fight will play out today in a county commission hearing. Daniela Levine-Cava, Miami-Dade County Commissioner, shares with us how county and city authorities are at odds and trying to resolve this the very best they can. Daniela, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why do you think the mayor was so concerned about losing federal funding that the decision was made to basically back away from the whole sanctuary idea?
Look, this mayor was in a very difficult situation. He not only was thinking about the federal dollars that we already receive, but he was thinking about some major infrastructure projects long overdue, for example, to build out our transit system. So I know that he was eager to demonstrate that we don't fit under this so-called sanctuary definition. And actually, he'd been working on that prior to even the election. However, we know that there are a lot of questions about this executive order and its legality, and that is being challenged by other jurisdictions, and I think we need to be part of that.
Can the commissioners do something to challenge the mayor?
Well, it's clear that the county commission is responsible for policy, not the mayor. The mayor's action would have to be determined to be temporary, and it will be reviewed by the county commission on February 17th.
Do you think this amounts to extortion?
You know, presidents do have the authority to issue executive orders. I don't know to what extent, ruling by executive order to this extent will be held up by the courts. And we've already seen some of these executive orders unravel in the federal courts. So, we understand the president wants to move quickly on his campaign promises, but it sets a very bad precedent for making decisions in this manner. We do have immigration laws. We do have departments. We do have Congress ready to act. And what is the urgency? What is the necessity to override local autonomy on these issues? We take great pride in Miami-Dade County. We're a so-called home rule charter jurisdiction, and that insulates us from some of the efforts of the state government, for example, to override our local rules. And we don't want to be ruled by the federal government. We want to have jurisdiction of our own law enforcement and corrections, and I see this as excessive. You know, the policy and the executive order actually puts our residents at risk, because many of our immigrants are very fearful of the immigration agency for a variety of reasons, and they see this as overreach. They see this as something that will potentially have a dragnet effect. So whether that's true or not, that is the perception, and there is a huge backlash of fear and anger about this executive order and our county capitulating to the president.
Daniela Levine-Cava is a Miami-Dade County Commissioner. If you think immigration regulations are whimsical or difficult to understand as of this week's legal battles over the immigration order from the Trump administration, check out our case in point this week from the Marshall Project. On October 14th of last year, Jules Latham was exonerated after nearly 3 decades behind bar for a crime he did not commit. Expecting freedom and to be reunited with his family, Jules was shocked when he was transferred from prison to an immigrant detention facility in Glades County, Florida. Now Jules is facing deportation to Haiti, a country he hasn't set foot in since the age of 17. His story is the subject of this week's Case in Point. Christy Thompson, a writer at the Marshall Project, joins us. Why is he headed back to Haiti?
Well, Jules may be headed back to Haiti. His case is still being decided. But when he had his sexual assault conviction overturned, ICE immigration officials realized that he still had a 30-year-old low-level drug conviction on his record, and they could absolutely deport him for that crime instead.
What were his expectations, as he must have been positively affected by the idea that it looked like he was to be exonerated?
his exoneration and attorneys did warn him that there, you know, he did have this drug conviction. It's possible that he would be facing immigration consequences once he got out. But there was definitely, you know, he won this huge victory after almost three decades and then was simply transferred to a different kind of jail.
Yeah, because I got taken up to Espoir, Saudi Ambassador.
I had a lot of hope because what they accused me of, I wasn't guilty of, and I thought God would help me.
After 27 years, the state found me not guilty.
After 27 years, the state found I was not guilty. They dismissed all the charges. It was the wrong person. It was a wrong conviction.
Did they ever find the person who did it?
I don't know, ma'am.
It's you asking the question there, and of course they don't know.
Yes, I went to Florida in January and visited with Jules at the Immigration Detention Center in rural Florida where he's being held, as well as visited with his family in the Little Haiti neighborhood of Miami who were, you know, still waiting to reunite with their brother and son.
27 years in jail for a crime he didn't commit, but there's still this drug conviction on the books. What's the maximum sentence you would receive for this drug conviction?
So when Jules got convicted of this drug conviction, which was delivery of cocaine, $20 worth of cocaine in 87, he did 5 months in jail but was sentenced to time served, which meant by the time he was sentenced, he'd already been in jail for 5 months, so they just let him go.
And so he has been convicted and already served his time?
Yes.
All right. Let's listen to what's transpired in the 27 years since he's been in custody of U.S. authorities.
My father passed away, my brother passed away, my sister passed away. They didn't even let me go and say goodbye and look at them.
He's clearly made mistakes, but is the penalty consistent with the crime here, both of them?
Well, that's for the immigration courts to decide. I think what's important to understand about the immigration system is there's no statute of limitations. This crime happened 30 years ago. Immigration did not come after him when it happened. But they can choose at any point, 50, 60 years later, that they still want to deport you for a crime that you did long ago.
So what happens now? What can his lawyers argue?
His lawyers are arguing two things. One, that it would be torture to send Jules back to Haiti. He has almost no family there. The ones that are still alive are naturalized U.S. citizens in the country now. And also, it's very common practice in Haiti to detain criminal deportees once they arrive in the country. So if Jules were deported, he would go from state prison to a U.S. immigration detention center, be sent to Haiti, and then likely be held in a Haitian jail for an unclear amount of time. And the conditions in those jails have been shown to be incredibly dangerous, cramped, and unsanitary. The other argument his lawyers are making is that there's a real humanitarian reason to let this man reunite with his family as, you know, sort of a compensation for the fact that he spent 30 years in prison for something he didn't do.
If he gets his day in court, he may make an argument not unlike this.
And the people know I'm innocent. I don't do nothing. I'm being sent to prison for 27 years and state just dismiss my case and drop it. I'm still in immigration waiting for another chance.
I'm still in immigration waiting for another chance. Did you ask him what he would do if he ever did find freedom here in the United States?
I did. I was curious. You know, you have to have pictured that day so crystal clear after spending 27 years in prison.
And had he?
He had, absolutely. He had very clear ideas of what he wanted to do his first day out.
First day when I get up, I'm going to the ocean, take a bath.
Yeah.
And I go to church.
Church?
I go to church, pray God, and me and my mom, and my mom have a dinner for me. Maybe some crab and lot soup.
Perhaps it's easy for us here at The Takeaway and you at the Marshall Project to get very sentimental about cases like these, but how is the legal status of Mr. Latom complicated by what's going on with the immigration cases that are being adjudicated from the executive orders of the Trump administration, if at all?
It's not exactly directed by what Trump has been doing for his first few weeks in office. But I think what's important to remember, or what Jules' case highlights, is that the system was already so severe in terms of how it treated most criminal convictions, particularly drug convictions like his. And now we have President Trump saying that he's only going to get more strict. He's saying that, you know, someone like Jules, who even if they were just charged with any criminal conviction, would be a priority for deportation. So it was already incredibly strict, and someone like Jules was already facing deportation, and it's only going to get more severe under Trump.
Christy Thompson is a writer at the Marshall Project and a writer of this week's Case in Point, looking at the case of Jules Atom, who was exonerated after nearly three decades behind bars for a crime he did not commit, yet he is still detained as an immigrant and may yet be sent back to Haiti. Christy Thompson, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Senate being equally divided, the vice president votes in the affirmative, and the nomination is confirmed.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. History in the Senate. Trump's nominee for the Department of Education, Betsy DeVos, is confirmed. But, boy, it wasn't easy. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is on the Hill. This was some history, right?
Yeah, it sure was, because Vice President Mike Pence, John, had to take the chair to break a 50-50 tie on Betsy DeVos. And that's the first time in the history of the Republic that a vice president has broken a tie on an executive nominee. Look, it's only happened about 240 times anyway on legislation. It's never happened on a cabinet nominee. So this was a first for Mike Pence in his role as president of the Senate. And it was so close for Betsy DeVos, who, by the way, is a Republican mega donor. People know by now she's 59 years old from Michigan, a billionaire thanks to the Amway fortune, and a major donor to many of the Republicans who voted for her today, John. But Betsy DeVos, by all counts, had a dismal, or poor, I should say, showing in her confirmation hearing, really unable to be conversant with some senators in some basics of educational and school assessment on the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which has been on the books in various forms for decades. It led two Republican senators, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski of Maine and Alaska, respectively, to vote against her. But that's what deadlocked the Senate at 50-50. There were protests in some of the states. There was an all-night speech protest by Democrats to try to put pressure on one more Republican to flip. It wasn't enough. 50-50. Betsy DeVos is confirmed. She's Education Secretary, John.
What does this mean for her programs and her views on education, you know, despite her, you know, lack of knowledge on certain aspects of educational reform? Where do those policies stand? Will they be less popular as a result? Will she have more difficulty as a result?
I have to say that the general public, I'm sorry to say, usually pays relatively little attention to what's going on at the Education Department, although they did when Common Core came out. It was a major issue for lots of voters, particularly in midterms. Now, Betsy DeVos herself, controversial, of course, but also her career as a funder and an activist in the education realm, she is going to face severe scrutiny. And why is that? Because she has a long career of being basically against public schools, or at least promoting major alternatives to public schools, religious schools, religious charters, private schools that get public money. Democrats call them vouchers. She's never gone to public school herself. Her children never went to public school. And a lot of Democrats highlighted that. So I think that you can expect education groups, teachers unions, Democrats to apply some pretty close scrutiny, more than usual, to an education secretary as she tries to implement Trump administration policies here.
Scrutiny and ripples, procedural ripples. I noticed that Jeff Sessions, for Attorney General, he's up next in the Senate. And the reason he was delayed, he was supposed to be confirmed last Friday. The reason he was delayed is they needed his vote for Betsy DeVos, right?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, Jeff Sessions is a senator. So if Jeff Sessions had been confirmed first, he would have become attorney general. And you can tell today by the result, 50-50, they needed that vote. So it was last week. I was hanging around outside the chamber door. John Cornyn came out. I said, what are you going to do with Sessions? He said, oh, we're just going to flip these. DeVos will go first. That's how we're going to solve that problem.
And they need an attorney general over there at DOJ with everything else that's going on. That's for sure. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
So Betsy DeVos is an advocate of charter schools and voucher programs. A lot of you are aware of that for educational reform. If you have any questions about educational options like charter schools and vouchers, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us your questions. We'll get them answered tomorrow on the program. Talk about power to the people. Look to the folks in Romania. More than 500,000 Romanians took to the streets over the weekend and actually successfully pressured the government into revoking an executive order protesters believed would absolve charges against some corrupt officials. Protests continued even after Prime Minister Sorin Grindeanu killed the order. Romania has the reputation as one of the most corrupt nations in Europe, but Romanians are shedding their famous cynicism and are actively trying to fight against government corruption. Ioana Moldovan is a freelance photojournalist and writer based in Romania. Welcome to The Takeaway, Ioana.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
How long and persistent has this feeling that the Romanian government is unredeemably corrupt have people had? I mean, on the street, almost everybody talks about it, at least when I spent time in Romania. How hard is this an impression to change?
Well, if you ask Romanians, they will tell you that corruption here is endemic. From small bribes here to high corruption in politics and public office. If you put it in more simple terms, for example, a total of 1,250 officials were indicted in 2015 alone with charges of high-level corruption.
And they have managed to get this executive order to supposedly absolve charges against corrupt officials, officials who openly took property and money belonging to the people. Is this a victory? Is this something that can't be reversed?
Well, people don't see it as a victory yet. That's why they still keep taking to the streets, because they don't trust the government anymore. There is a completely lack of trust in the executive. People say that they no longer know what the government will do next. In the morning, there is one thing, one decision. In the afternoon, that decision is reversed. So they want more transparency from the government. They want every decree and every law to be put in front of the people for them to know what their government is about to do. And that was not happening in this case.
These are the largest protests since 1989 when the Soviet Union fell. I remember the fall of Ceausescu. People at that time relied on the military to be the trusted institution to force change in the government. Is there any such institution that's trusted that could work on behalf of the people to make permanent changes here?
Well, I don't think we are there yet. And we hope that we will not come to the same situation as in 1989. I was only 9 back then, so I wasn't in the streets like children these days are in the streets in Bucharest. But things are somewhat different to the 89 revolution. As I said, protesters now ask for respect, and they demand the government respect to the basic principles of a democratic society, like rule of law. And looking at the largest demonstrations, as you said, since 1989, as a Romanian, you cannot help but to feel admiration and empowerment. Most foreign media outlets ran headlines like power of the people. And I think this is the best summary of what has been happening in Romania over the last week. So I don't believe the people on the streets in Romania need the army. I think their pressure and what they are doing is now maybe not sufficient, but it's at the right place, and they are making their voice heard, and they are standing up and saying no more to the political class.
Ioana Moldovan is a freelance photojournalist and writer based in Romania. Thank you so much, Ioana.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for your attention on what is happening in Romania.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, helping Americans with legal needs for over 15 years, including business formation and estate plans through a network of independent attorneys licensed in 48 states. More information at LegalZoom.com.
The tweet-happy and garrulous President Donald Trump has expressed pride in how many foreign leaders he has spoken with during his transition and after his inauguration. The leader of Japan actually visited Trump Tower right after the election. China's President Xi Jinping was among the first world leaders to congratulate the president-elect by phone, but the president of Taiwan called Trump on December 2nd, raising all kinds of questions. In all, there are 18 foreign leaders that the president has spoke to since his inauguration. Some have not gone so well, as in the phone conversation with the Australian leader Malcolm Turnbull, which ended with what some described as a hang-up and the New York Times said was simply abruptly ended by President Trump. But despite numerous communications back and forth and a phone call with Russia's Vladimir Putin, there has been no substantive communication with Chinese President Xi Jinping since taking office. This unusual situation sets the stage for a series of recommendations from a group of 14 experts, from diplomats to economists, impaneled by China expert Orville Schell. He's the Arthur Ross Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Orville Schell, welcome.
Pleasure.
So, first of all, how does this delay and mysterious hesitation on the part of the administration to engage with China affect the recommendations that you're making?
Well, one of our recommendations is that President Trump early on make a call, get together with President Xi, because this is a relationship of incomparable importance. On the other hand, before he does that, we ardently hope that he will formulate some comprehensive strategy for how he intends to go forward rather than just pixelate the picture bit by bit in a rather spontaneous fashion, which could be quite dangerous. So we hope the interaction goes quickly and that it happens soon, but that it takes place with a certain judiciousness and preparation.
So there's tons here to talk about in this embargoed report, but what you're saying there is actually his delay might be a good thing based on some of the spontaneous statements that may cause more problems than solutions in comments on foreign affairs up till now.
Well, I'm here in Washington now, and I've been going around talking to people at the White House, State Department, Defense Department, the Congress, and I think the general feeling of everybody is that the Trump administration has not yet found its sea legs. Its people have not been fully appointed. They've not fully connected up to form a sort of a really comprehensive network of how to communicate with each other. So it's early on. And, of course, this also sits on top of the president's tendency to tweet late at night, his sort of inner sentiments, which tend to upset things. So it's a very volatile situation.
Speaking of volatile situations, your number one recommendation in the executive draft here is work with China to halt North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Do you think that's possible? What progress can be made early on, do you think?
I think our new president owes it to the president of China to give this one last try. We've not been very successful in the past. The only real way to, I think, bring North Korea to heel on the nuclear question is if China is fully cooperating on sanctions, to sanction its trading companies, the banking, because most of the leakage in terms of China's sort of economic activity to the world goes through China. Now, whether Xi Jinping will agree, I don't know. No one does. But actually, the U.S. and China here do share a real common interest in not having nuclear weapons in Kim Jong-un's hands in North Korea. But if they cannot forge some sort of a collaborative process very quickly, then I think our task force suggests that the U.S. move unilaterally towards secondary sanctions against Chinese companies, banks, and other enterprises that are doing business with North Korea. This is an urgent matter.
Let me combine a couple of things here. You want to move ahead on cyber issues with China and also Taiwan and Hong Kong. Do you think progress is possible there?
Well, I think, you know, the Taiwan question raises the whole dilemma of the one China system, which Donald Trump did call into question. whatever you may think about it, it is sort of the keystone of the arch of U.S. policy to China and to Asia. And we have so many other urgent matters begging our attention. I think our task force members all feel it would be foolish to meddle with this fundament right now, that we should leave it be. It's not in Taiwan's interest to have China rattling swords and possibly some military action to reunify China. And let's get on with questions that are of more immediate urgency than disturbing that. But that said, I think everyone also agrees that the U.S.-China relationship is out of balance, whether you look at trade and investment, whether you look at human rights, whether you look at media, denial of visas, the inability of media outlets to operate freely to distribute in China, whether you look at the NGO law, which is prejudicing the ability of foreign NGOs to work collaboratively in China and build a decent relationship with China. All of these things beg attention. And I think if we can't get a handle on it soon, we may find the hope of engagement dwindling before our eyes.
In the last minute, I'm going to combine another two because there are so many really important issues here to deal with. You want to sustain and broaden U.S.-China collaboration on global climate change. Is that even possible, Orville Schell? And how does this new relationship with Russia complicate matters that you've tried to sort of put forward with these recommendations?
I think after the nuclear issue in North Korea, there is nothing that begs more attention and more urgency than climate change. And the U.S. and China actually have developed a very good relation on this front. And one can only hope that the Trump administration will continue these efforts, not only because climate change is a threat to everyone in the world, but because it is actually a very constructive, positive area of collaboration between the U.S. and China. And in these fraught times, we need such collaboration more than ever.
Orville Schell is the Arthur Ross Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. You can see the full report by going to the Asia Society's website. Orville, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
What constitutes racial justice following a scourge like slavery? The slave-owning political philosophers and anti-colonial rebels back in the 1700s were not ignorant of the idea of blacks and whites living together. There were places all over the Enlightenment world where such was the case. Even the very international city of New Orleans, right here in the United States, in its early days was the most cosmopolitan place in America, multiracial and free. But as America's government emerged and the difficult economic compromises and contradictions of ending slavery became clear, America's great early leaders envisioned a way, tragically flawed way, that blacks and whites, and even Indians, Native Americans, would live together equally.
When I say that these enlightened, I call them liberal because that's the way they used to describe themselves, liberal Americans believed in the equality, the kind of potential and equality of people of color, they believed in their potential to become like white people, or actually become white.
Actually become white. That's historian Nicholas Guyot, who says that because America did not have a realistic vision of a diverse nation of different peoples, it invented separate but equal, the tragic doctrine responsible for so much death and misery in America. Separate but equal was invented by Americans long ago. His new book, Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation, shows how a well-meaning theory in America led to such a bitter end that we're still dealing with today.
One thing which a lot of folks now who feel like they are, I mean, particularly white people who feel like they're having trouble getting a handle on the race issue, one of the things they feel is that, you know, for the past 200, 250 years, the United States has been on this kind of journey. And it's a journey that's made the principles of the Declaration of Independence more expansive. And I think the problem with this journey narrative is it overlooks the fact that there are some really difficult work in terms of managing integration, managing coexistence that dates right the way back to the first days of the Republic.
And the way you describe it, segregation becomes a mechanism for dealing with this, where are people going to live? And I don't think people had necessarily an idea of what the consequences would be, but it was their invention. Is invention the right word?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would say that segregation became a solution for high-minded, the word I use in the book is enlightened white Americans. So I'm talking here about many of the founding fathers who styled themselves as children of the Enlightenment, you know, who believed in, they believed in abstract human equality, or at least they told each other they did, that segregation eventually became for them a kind of way of managing the racial diversity of the new United States. You know, I would say the majority of the founding fathers recognized that, in theory at least, slavery was wrong. Similarly, in terms of Native Americans. So what you have here is a kind of self-styled, enlightened class of leaders thinking about how they can manage the 25% roughly of the American population that was not white, and in effect move that population into a place where it could be part of the American Republic, a fundamental part of it. And the problems they have in doing that, I mean, there are many, there are legion, and I write about them in the book, but segregation becomes in the end these enlightened American solutions to the problem. I mean, you know, in short, it's can we persuade Native Americans or black people to move somewhere else? And maybe set up something like the United States somewhere else even, but get away from us. So achieve equality through separation.
But do you think that if you could have waved a wand and suddenly African Americans as slaves were just as educated as the Jeffersons and Ben Franklins of the world and Native Americans the same way, would the landowners in the United States in the South and North have gone, okay, let's all get together?
Well, it's funny you say that because, I mean, bound up in the premise of your question is actually a premise that these founders had themselves. When I say that these enlightened, I call them liberal because that's the way they used to describe themselves, liberal Americans believed in the equality, the kind of potential inequality of people of color, they believed in their potential to become like white people. Or actually become white in some cases. So you had all sorts of race theorists, the Princeton president, Samuel Stanhope Smith, who believed that people of color would literally become white. Their skin color, their facial features would actually change if they were placed in the proximity of white people and they did the same kinds of jobs. So not field labor, but they began to do the same kinds of things that people like Thomas Jefferson did. So in a sense, what you see is this idea of equality, which is rooted in the notion that actually it's all about being white. So one of the kind of tragicomic elements of this is that it becomes clear after 1800 that people of color, even those who've been sent like some sons of Indian chiefs to Princeton, they aren't becoming white. Or African Americans who've moved to Philadelphia or who were born in New York or Boston aren't becoming white. So then, of course, you have this attendant problem, which is if they're not going to become white, then what will be the future of them living in equality with white people, which is where you get anxieties about racial mixing.
So what do you think explains the dreadful carnage that comes as a result of Reconstruction and the Jim Crow period, or the genocide that took place in California and the Pacific Northwest as really the manifest destiny took hold?
We tend conventionally to think about this battle against slavery ending in the Civil War as a kind of regionalizing the problem of race in American history. So we tend to see the Northerners, Northern whites, as being mostly the good guys who got rid of slavery, and Southerners as the people who benefited from it and kind of entrenched it. Well, actually, this idea of segregation was Northern or national, dated all the way back to the beginning of the American Republic, and it was liberal rather than conservative. And I would argue that one of the reasons for Reconstruction's failure is that very large numbers of white people in the North had never imagined that white people would have to integrate with people of color in the same space. And that kind of deep-rooted inheritance of segregationist thinking has this Northern edge to it, rather than just being something that one can blame Southern whites for.
Does this history get us off the hook?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm from Britain. I'm the pastiest white man you could ever meet. But they are that there has always been a problem here of adjusting, shall we say, of trying to make recompense, which involves a surrender of white privilege. And certainly for early white Americans, so, you know, the leaders of the Republic during its first few decades, in a sense, they talked the talk, but they never walked the walk because the price of surrendering white privilege was too high. I mean, in the end, it was absolutely unaffordable for them because actually, you know, the profitability of slavery became enormous during the cotton period. So in a sense, the way to solve this problem is now, as it always was then, firstly, to recognize that people of color have a crucial role to play. You have a lot to learn from them in terms of thinking about what equality means. And the second is you need to accommodate yourself to the surrender of privilege. And I mean, for people
so genius. That is, Americans need to articulate what white privilege is and how it is a piece in this negotiation for living together.
I think that's incredibly hard for people that don't feel very privileged. And I mean, again, it's about listening to others, right? I mean, it's not very much recompense to hear some elite white professor telling you that you need to surrender your privilege when you don't feel like you have very much. But in some respects, as a historian, one of the biggest jobs you can play is actually articulating the relationships in terms of power and understanding between these racial groups at this formative moment in the history of the United States. And I think you see the story much more clearly, at least I hope, from the angle I've tried to tell it from.
Nicholas Guyatt is the author of Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
My name is Penny. I'm calling from Florida. I'm just wondering why a court is allowed to overturn orders of our president who is trying to protect our country.
Questions arising out of a constitutional crisis in the United States right now. Where is the power of the president? We'll be diving into these questions on President's Day. We'll have an hour devoted to executive power, how it has changed over time, what it should look like in the future. We hope you'll join us on February 20th. In the meantime, we always want to hear from you. Give us your views at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story. Send us a tweet. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.